The exploration and development of oil and gas leases sold by the state of Alaska. The lease contains a contractual obligation for the operator to drill and develop the lease within a specified time or surrender the lease. Some overzealous state employees, however, have opinions that do not agree with the state policy and its inclusion of this requirement. At a public hearing in Anchorage on February the 6th, 1981, on the Uniform Permit Procedures Regulations, the AOGA witness complained that it was becoming almost impossible for an operator to drill on his oil and gas lease. One of the hearing officers publicly advised the witness, and I quote, "You might say that when the state sells an oil and gas lease, that we've implied that you can go out and drill holes in the lease, but that's not necessarily the case," unquote. I'd like to point out a couple of the more general problems that industry faces. One of the most significant of the problems that state agencies are trying to design installations for industry. They do not have the experience nor the qualified personnel to do this. We believe they should set standards and ensure that industry meet those standards. If this trend is not reversed, it's going to take considerably more state employees to enforce the statutes and the regulations in the future. A second problem is that added costs seem to mean nothing to regulators. Companies are having problems with state agencies, for example, in the re-siting of pads and roads. Industry people decide on the design after on-site evaluation, study, and then consideration and balancing of such factors as safety, environmental problems, and costs. The regulators have no qualms about throwing all of this effort out and specifying that it be moved somewhere else. Just last week, one of our operator's representatives complained about the lost effort and added cost, and a state regulator advised, quote, "We're tired of hearing the oil industry complain about costs," unquote. In order to eliminate problems of this kind, we hope the legislature will adopt the version of SB 84 which we recommend. Agencies should carry out the law, but it should be made clear through the legislative process that zero-risk concept is neither practical nor required. Time and time again, industry is forced to reinvent the wheel in each new area of operations where different regulatory people are employed who demand zero risk. It cannot be achieved, but reasonable precautions can be taken. It is industry's intent to operate in accordance with all applicable laws and regulations. The regulators can cause eventual severe financial and delay problems for industry. In the interest of time, industry is forced to accept stipulations in many instances which it believes are invalid, ill-founded, and are not in the best interest of the state. Due to seasonal restrictions, our industry, at least up until now, has not been able to afford the luxury of an additional year to argue with the agencies nor to seek relief in the courts. This is an added cost of doing business which ultimately has to be paid for by the consumer. This involuntary capitulation gives the illusion on the surface at least of relative calm and acquiescence to the regulatory process. It ends up in the regulator making you an offer that you can't refuse. The industry has been operating in a prudent manner, and operations have not significantly affected wildlife. On the other hand, oil and gas operations have been very beneficial, having created a large number of jobs and furnishing significant revenues to the state. In these times when so many people are out of work, it would be good to have more projects moving to employ people. Many of the planned projects are being held up, thus helping create unemployment. If the state gives the oil and gas industry the opportunity, it will operate in a prudent and safe manner. At the same time, we urge you to take a firm stand in assuring that permits can be obtained in a reasonable time and with reasonable stipulations. Mr. Chairman, the witnesses who will follow me will tell you some of the specific problems that industry is having in permitting, and then Mr. Bond will introduce a draft of a bill which we believe would cure many of the problems. fifth draft represents our wish list, if you please, for legislation on this subject. We recognize our other versions which have been proposed in consultation with the administration, which also have merit for you to consider. Mr. Chairman, the other witnesses are here, and then we will all, of course, be available for any questions that you might wish. We have to answer questions. That's Senator Monk.
I had two or three questions, maybe to help me understand better for the testimony. One of the questions I'd like to know is what percentage of new permits, in your opinion, utilize to the fullest the information gathered on previous like permit requests? And what percentage of the permits are considered simultaneously? Does each permit considered require a prior permit to be approved first? And my third question is, looking at the time factor here that you give for each permit, you gave us a figure of 42 permits to drill for oil. But my question there is the 31 and a half days to 83 and a half days average indicate the total time for securing permits, which a little fast multiplication here indicates to me in some cases it could be up to 9 years. Is that true?
No, I think I might need to clarify there in answer to your last point. There are many kinds of permits that are required to drill a well, and the figures that I quoted are just the average. There are some of those permits that require only one day. Some of them require 300 days, as Roger Herrera told you. We have had some permits that have gone something over 700 days, but those are the unusual ones. Basically, I believe the agencies will process one permit at a time. I'm sure that they refer back to other permits, but it's not unusual for them to condition the approval of a permit on us getting some other permit. And I'm sorry I didn't write down your first 2 points.
What I was, in a sense, you may have answered that, because I asked what percentage of the permits are considered simultaneously. Does each permit considered require a prior permit to be approved first? And I think in a sense
some do, and I have no knowledge of just how the agencies work, but one of the problems that our people do have is that certain people are delegated responsibility to act on these permits, and if that person's on vacation, the permit lies on their desk till he comes back.
Okay, and the other question, to make sure that I understand, the new permits that you're requesting, for example, in another site, you'll say, in your opinion, do regulatory agencies utilize to the fullest the information gathered on previous like permit applications? In other words, it seems to me that if it took you 6 months to get one previously, there's been a lot of study going in it, and you got a like permit coming up, maybe in the same area, do you find that they still take about 6 months or another 10 yards down that chicken track over there?
Representative Moss, if I might, I'd like to attend to some of the people who get permits in the audience.
Well, there's no set plan of action then, apparently. In other words, today you might be on top of the world, tomorrow you might be down in the depths. In other words, what goes today doesn't go tomorrow, is that what you say?
No prediction.
No prediction at all that you can operate on. The predictability is down the tube.
Yes.
And that's why we got 20 feet of turkey track over there. Thank you.
Yes, Joe, a couple of questions. I want to explore a little bit from your quote where you said someone in the state agencies said that, quote, united is in the face of wells and oil and gas rates that we've implied that you can go out and get a hold of the case, but not necessarily the case. Do you want to explore that with any cities or figure out, and is that in fact a policy of the state that your lease is not in fact guarantee the right after you comply with stipulations to...
Oh, I think there's no question it doesn't guarantee you the right to drill a well. You still have to get a permit as if you didn't have a lease. The lease force gives you the right to drill a well, but you do have to comply with all regulations. And then as you get the permit, the stipulations are added on to that. Those stipulations, some are put on the lease before the operator takes the lease, but others then are added when you get the permit.
Would it be possible, in your opinion, to, and would it be helpful, to have many of these stipulations on the lease prior to the lease sale?
We've encouraged the administration to put as many as possible. An operator, if the stipulations are too stringent or too difficult or too restrictive, he may not even want to bid on the lease. And the state does put stipulations on before the lease is bid, but it certainly gives you no guarantee that you will get the drill a well on it unless you meet all the stipulations that are placed on later.
Now, I guess my question is there any chance that the stipulations are already put on prior to lease and you know what you're buying?
I don't think it'd be possible to put all stipulations on, but certainly most of them, the more important ones, should be put on. There probably are some site-specific instances where you couldn't, but there should be some way to itemize those so that an operator knows. We operated for 15 years around here with one page of stipulation. All the leases in Kirkland, all the leases of Pluto up to the time of discovery had one page of stipulation.
Did you list to me all the bad things that happened back then?
Well, we produced a lot of oil, we drilled wells successfully, and 100% of the oil production in Alaska today comes from leases that were drilled under those stipulations.
One other question, and I really would like to just have your opinion of how you think the public interest is being served or not served by the situations as it exists today.
Well, everything to Randolph, in my job, I'm a professional hearing lawyer, if you please. Mm-hmm. My job is to have testimony on behalf of all the judges. And I go to hearings and I see the same 20 people that every hearing. I don't care how many hearings you have, you're going to have 10 or 15 or 20 people there, and there are about 15 of them that go regularly. It may be five of this group and five of some other group and five of some other group, and then there may be three or four people from the public there. Not often do you get good public response. So most of the public hearing process, in my own personal opinion, is you're not getting public opinion. You're getting the opinion of three or four or five groups who have vested interest in that field.
So I guess my question was, if all this process, this whole committee process, is supposed to be to protect the public interest, in your opinion, the situation that exists today, does it do that, or, you know, what is the public interest? In weight of the Caribou or the millions of Americans that are getting advantages of what we're all doing?
I think the people of Alaska, they have a bunch of state employees who are employed to look after the public interest. The legislature passes the laws and they're there to implement the laws and they're supposed to look after the public interest. We don't seem to be doing that. We seem to be asking the public to tell all the state employees what to do and for every action. And I don't think that's necessarily in the public interest. We think that the employees should carry out their function.
Let's go to my actually, this may be kind of off the subject, but I just like to...
That was my personal opinion, sir.
I'm going to be asking some questions tomorrow night. The implementation of the ACMP, Alaska Coastal Management Plan program, and consistent to the examination group, I understand it's created a duplicative and conflicting regulation of the oil and gas permits and so forth. Can you give me an example of the duplication and some of the ones, for example, is my understanding now is we may have one regulation that is counterproductive to another. Can you give me some illustrations of that? Today they say the sun is going to shine, but then you're looking at it, and the other regulations say no, it ain't. It's moonshine.
Representative Moss, Sean Glass is going to present some testimony after me on that very thing. If I can put it under that.
I think when we're ready for Mr. Don Glass. And, for the committee, I'd like to ask if we can hold questions for these next four representatives of AOGA, and then I think we'll get a better picture of maybe the concerns that we have. And that'll also put us on time so that we'll have the two representatives speak right before lunch pertaining to the government department. And right after lunch, I'd like to begin with Mr. Joyce Munson's presentation. Mr. Glass?
Mr. Chairman, my name is John Glass, located in Anchorage with Shell Oil Company, and manager of Coastal Environmental Activities. And I'm here today speaking on behalf of the Glass Oil and Gas Association. I'll discuss delay and access problems created by consistency authority, as it has been exercised under the Alaska Coastal Management Program. I'm handing out that material at the time because I refer to certain portions of it and other portions which will not be covered by me will perhaps be useful in hearing the testimony to answer questions such as Representative Moss recently inquired into. The Federal Coastal Zone Management Act requires that private activities which could affect the land and water uses of the coastal zone must receive a favorable sign-off from an affected state with an approved DBM program, or no federal license or permit can be issued. This has been troublesome for the Alaskan petroleum industry since the Alaskan Coastal Management Program was enacted in 1979. A number of problem examples are attached to the hearing record. These examples range all the way from individual state agencies rendering conflicting consistency determinations in connection with their individual permit agencies, to having state agencies require stipulations in federal permits which go beyond their agency authority and which are not included in their own agency permits, to having the Corps of Engineers deny issuance of a wetlands permit which would otherwise would have approved because regulations precluded that issuance without the ACMC consistency determination. It may be useful to look briefly at one of these real life situations, and your attention is drawn to the attached example designated at the top as Appendix A4 with the number 79 written in the lower right hand corner. In that example, an oil company applied to the Corps of Engineers in June of 1980 for a 404 wetlands permit to construct a gravel drilling pad to be located on strip in the Beaufort Sea on a state lease. The company planned to construct the pad during the 1980-81 winter season so it would be ready for drilling during the subsequent season. Such a permit, as you heard earlier this morning, requires a Section 401 water quality certification from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and a consistency certification from the Alaska Office of Coastal Management, which is in CCDC, Department of Policy Development and Planning. In addition to these two certifications, a number of other state and federal agencies and other interested parties are brought into the act by solicitation of comments. To make a long story short, reference to the delay and chronology sections of the example show the following. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service insisted that the issue be broadened and construction of the gravel pad to include the ultimate use of the pad. Their comments to the Corps were delayed until 144 days after application submitted. The National Marine Fisheries Service joined the Wildlife Service in insisting on a permit stipulation that drilling be restricted to November 1 through March 31. The Department of Environmental Conservation requested a number of delays, which were granted by OPM. And in October, ADEC further responded to a request for a hearing in October, although earlier hearing had not appeared necessary. The 4-1 certification was issued 170 days after application submitted. In the next step, the Office of Coastal Management denied a consistency determination 222 days after the application submitted on the basis of the lack of data and information. That data and information relating to subsequent operations rather than construction of the pad. The final action had the Corps denying the permit 242 days after permit application. The Corps noted that it found the issuance in the public interest, but that their issuance was precluded by regulations without a favorable consistency determination. This is an example of the complex permitting process as it relates to energy development in Alaska, in which indiscriminate actions by permitting and certifying agencies and other parties are allowed and encouraged. In this example, consistency authority had the effect of filling a permit, even after all other agencies and parties had been satisfied, albeit through imposition of questionable stipulations. The company involved initially appealed the consistency denial to the Secretary of Commerce, a long and uncertain process in itself, from which I understand the company has withdrawn. That concludes my discussion of that example. After near passage by the 1980 session of the legislature of a permit reform bill supported by a variety of industries in our state, the administration announced that regulatory reform was a matter of important interest to them as well. For a time, we were encouraged by the appearance in the proposed Uniform Permit Procedure Regulation of such industry-supported concepts as that there be a knowledgeable lead state agency designated for any particular activity. Such lead agency would make the state's single consistency determination to serve both state and federal purposes and would be responsible for transmitting the state's comments relevant to any federal permit. These encouraging steps were offset, however, by other new provisions which, in our view, would prevent the lead agency from performing as a lead agency. The designated agency, for example, would have to accord any district, borough, municipality, IEA, whatever, with an approved coastal plan, the status of a state resource agency. The designated agency would then have to give the recommendations of such a district, as well as those of other state resource agencies, state weight. And state weight was an important concept which then went through a series of twists and turns to mean at various times that the lead agency must defer to the district and agencies if the recommendation is in their area of expertise, that the lead agency must defer unless balancing was involved, with a district later accepted from that balancing provision, and in the most recent proposal, that the lead agency would bear the burden of proof if it were to reach a conclusion contrary to a recommendation of such a district or agency. We see the net effect of the current proposal as giving a district the opportunity to interpret its coastal program with respect to the consistency determination on any energy activity, whether onshore or even distantly offshore. If the lead agency placed in a weak position to overcome that district or agency's recommendation, in effect, the district could exercise a virtual veto over activities in the state interest conducted pursuant to a lease on state, federal, or other lands. The result anticipated would be further delay in and possible exclusion of energy developments which are in the national and state interest. To compound the potential for confusion and third-party challenges from such unclear timing of authority, the appeals process and the proposed procedures is much longer and more complicated than that currently employed, and others will go more deeply into that. In short, the industry views the current state regulatory reform effort so compromised as promising little or no remedy to our past and present problems with consistency. I'd be happy to respond to any questions now. I gather from your recent panel, Mr. Chairman, you'd like to hold questions.
I thought Ms. Bryson might have us move along with the committee recommendation, and then we'll have Mr. Tim DeRigo. Mr. DeRigo. Ms. Mega, could you have a speak louder, please? I'm going to put you in a table.
You can hold the mic if you want. This is all preliminary. I was just standing at the front of my job and I was going to design a panel of Pluto Bell. I'd like to point out your attention that at the end of my 4 or 5 pages of the testimony of the chronology of the work on this particular issue that I'm going to talk about, which involves the Pluto Bell geoscience system and services, which you know that it and also involves an effect in the permitting process that takes place at the park with it, which is all the way over here.
How far is that?
About 15 miles. I'd also like to apologize for the fact that I'm going to stick so closely to my written testimony and what you're talking about, right? So it might be a little bit, uncomfortable for me. I will be using a lot of acronyms in this testimony. You may be familiar with them, things like GNOM and US personnel. I will refer to any testimony in the testimony by acronyms. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Tim DeRigo. I am chaired by Alpha Alaska Inc., but I'm speaking on behalf of the Alaska Air and Gas Association, known as AOGA. As we together have told you, the purpose of my presentation to you today is to discuss the broad topic of permit and other stipulations which are imposed on industry and we feel are not justified, but rather are based on environmental issues which are hypothesized. The vehicle for this discussion will be, as I pointed out, the example of permitting two Pluto Bay geosites, which are geosites 16 and 17. In this case, while extended discussions of the hypothetical effects are conducted, a real and readily apparent wildlife issue is totally ignored. In the course of this discussion, however, I will touch on a couple of other terms which are not apparent to someone looking at the system from an on-road vantage point
Nonetheless, it's very real. They are first, the interlocking web of agency jurisdictions to which industry is subject. They can entangle a project into an informal but well-used communications network between state, federal, and local agencies. These can result in a situation where, in this example, a claim that a state agency could not incorporate as a stipulation into a state permit, instead is incorporated into a federal permit. This is well pointed out by the attached analogy of events. Second, the delay that can be caused by negotiating oneself out of a situation which is initially caused by an existence of an unjustifiable stipulation being imposed. It appears that the potential for this delay may be used as a negotiating tactic to obtain certain desired ends. Many times, this results in an inordinate amount of effort to document that the field result will not in fact occur, or to make a change in the scope of the project which, while appearing to be minor, is still possible. The impossibility of proving that a hypothesized result will not occur is not only often, but in most cases impossible. This issue will be referred to again in a later presentation. One point I'd like to make is that either an effort to document that it will not occur or a change, both impose additional costs. The example is as follows. In the spring of 1979, Atlantic Eastfield Company, now known as ECHO, submitted applications to the Division of Minerals and Energy Management, DMEM, for a plan of operations approval and to the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers for a Section 404 shoreline wetlands permit to construct two new drill sites, as I pointed out, access roads, pipeline construction pads, and pipelines at the part of the Kittle Bay development east of the Southern Verkhoff River, that's known as the Side River. The proposed configuration of these facilities is similar to that of all other offshore-operated development drill sites at Kittle Bay. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game and its federal counterpart, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, stipulated that ECHO mitigate conditions and hypothetical effects on caribou that were based on new conjecture. The basic concerns expressed were that caribou may be impeded in their periodic migration to the coast by a physical as well as a visual barrier. The physical barrier is the pipeline, and the visual barrier is the proximity of the pipeline to the construction pad. And on this drawing, Paraphrase an agency representative, and this is the basis of the issues in this case, you have to learn how to think like a caribou. The visual barrier of the pipeline, which is 5 feet above the tundra at the power support, in close proximity to the 3-foot gravel pipeline construction pad, is feared to constitute a visual impediment which might construct caribou on route to the coast. Also, the presence of workmen during the summer construction season has advanced as a reason to limit human activity during the summer months. This was in the face of documented evidence that caribou can acclimatize themselves to pre-existing structures and human activity in Kittle Bay, and that was ignored. Further, while the negotiations on these issues dragged on for approximately 7 months from initial permit application submittal, the fact that proposed access roads from drill site 3, which is right here, to drill site 16 and 17, went directly over an old, established, and highly active fast stand was overlooked by the agency. In fact, ECHO's resident wildlife biologist discovered this prior to current issuance, and as a result, the road was rerouted. Through numerous discussions with the concerned state and federal agencies, it became apparent that the claims of potential severe and adverse effects on caribou could neither be substantiated nor documented. I stand by the attacks and I agree with that. Agency position resolved from the total prohibition of drone construction activities from July 1 to August 10, and the prohibition of the use of construction pads to a final settlement with pipeline construction pads. To a final settlement with dictated a 400-foot gap in the pipeline construction pads for Caribou migration users. The information is just we don't know if there's a pipeline construction plan from the very top of the world that could not be done. Since DMAN, the American Energy Management, to its credit, recognized the inequity of the proposed comments and therefore did not include them, this and going needed comments to the Corps of Engineers to mandate the mitigating measures if deemed desirable. The operators on the North Slope strongly feel that they design, build, or operate their projects to the highest possible standard. We strive to do at least 100% of whatever is necessary to protect the environment. We have some recommendations based on this example. First, arbitrary stipulations should not be imposed unless there is factual data supporting an agency's potential and not mere conjecture. Second, there should be no absolute prohibitions on construction or operations in a development area. Third, mitigating requirements should be directly related to the activities involved in the permit application pending approval. A manned checkpoint 15 miles away on the Patak River, the activity east of the Shad River, is the most blatant example of the lack of a direct relationship. Finally, resource agencies' attention and expertise should focus on mitigating readily identifiable impacts, such as the desirability to bypass the soft zone in the passage of proposed access roads, rather than focusing on hypothetical impacts. For information, the permit BC drill site, we had to put a manned checkpoint right there. That roads which run generally in the east-west direction or pipeline would impede them and so would traffic on those roads. So initially, as you look in the chronology of events, the initial Fish and Game request or stipulation would be, and this is the second one, the initial response was in June. There was another one from October to DMAM in July, late June. Fish and Wildlife got in the picture in July. In September, Fish and Game said, well, we can't use the US road here, and therefore we're going to have a main checkpoint here. To make sure that the travel traffic on those roads is kept to an absolute minimum. That was in addition to an absolute prohibition on drilling and construction activities from July 1 to August 10. On September 24 and 25, there was a day and a half meeting, and I talked to the person who was directly involved, who was at that meeting and was involved with permitting this issue. And I said, please tell me how we got from here to there. And he characterized it as pure horse trading. And that was because they also had an east-west route which went out to the Kapark development area, that it was the manned checkpoint here became a manned checkpoint over there to limit or to restrict or reduce traffic on that major east-west route. So the issue was the same, but it moved 15 miles. The issue is the east-west potential impediment to service.
I'm sure you've developed many questions in our mind, but in hopes of getting along, I'd like to ask the board to hold this question until Mr. Don Hinkle speaks.
The good news is it's going to be brief. I too have trouble reading testimony. My name is Dan Hinkle. I'm with Marathon Oil Company, testifying on behalf of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. My presentation will briefly discuss duplication and give you one example. On the first chart over here, you see Alaska Stat 1605-870, the statutory authority for the Department of Fish and Game to identify and regulate anadromous fish camps. 870 was amended by the 1980 legislature to read as it is presented on the chart. On the handout, I've also got the superseded statute. Under the old version, the Commissioner of Fish and Game was required to identify anadromous fish tags, which he has done in this set of books here. Known the list of waters important to anadromous fish. In the amendment that came in 1980, the commissioner has to relist these streams by July 31, 1982, or their fish classification will expire. Under the regulatory part of the statute, you'll note the requirement to get fish and game approval for certain activities affecting anadromous fish streams. Section B. Here's the regulations in addition to the list of waters that we have to deal with for 870. In all fairness to the department, the majority of those regulations deal with penalties if you violate the statute. By now, you've noted that there's certain underlying language both of these, and I'd ask for you to compare the language to 1610.010, which is the Department of Environmental Conservation. And that's their statutory authority on, in a sense, the salmon spawning streams and waters. This statute also requires one obstructing, diverting, polluting a salmon stream to get a permit from the Department of Environmental Conservation. Here are the regs that we have under that statute. Needless to say, what we're looking at here for all practical purposes are two identical statutes, two different agencies, two different permits for the same activity. In the interest of time and in an effort to avoid any duplication on my part, I'll conclude the testimony at this point.
Well, nothing like a good example. Mr. Tom Cook.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Thomas Cook. I'm employed by Chevron USA as exploration representative for Alaska. I appear before you today on behalf of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association. The purpose of my statement this morning is to call to your attention some problems that we have with the pre-sale decision-making process leading to leasing, particularly with the social, economic, and environmental analysis, or the SEA, which is undertaken by the Governor's Agency Advisory Committee on Leasing. I will also bring to your attention some of the problems which arise from the interagency permit review process. And these problems basically stem, we think, from certain memorandum of understanding which has been entered into between various agencies. As pointed out by Mr. Gilbert, the permitting process which has been imposed on the petroleum industry has become very complex, burdensome, and lengthy. More importantly, we almost always have unreasonable requirements imposed on permit approval through stipulation. And at this point, I'd like to second Mr. Herrera's statement earlier this morning that stipulations are not bad in themselves, and we've been living with them for a long time. I think our problem is with wholesale prescriptions and prohibitions which are not tied to the particular permitting question. One important mechanism by which these stipulations are imposed on leases is through the CIA process. Another way in which stipulations are imposed is through the permit approvals as a result of the interagency review process. And incidentally, an MOU, and I'll refer to it that way from now on, is a formal agreement between two or more agencies to use coordinated procedures and decisions concerning the respective responsibilities of parties to that MOU or agreement. And DNR has, in fact, agreed to allow other agencies to review permit applications and to recommend terms and conditions for permit approval. Gravel extraction, which is of critical importance in Arctic operations, has been unreasonably restricted by the Department of Fish and Game. These are all areas over which the Department of Fish and Game has no authority under law. We believe the CIA has become a prime example of government and bureaucratic excess. Many agencies involved in the preparation of the CIA use the process to assert authority over leasing and subsequent oil and gas operations. Agencies without statutory authority of oil and gas leasing operations have embraced the CIA as a means of asserting control over the process. The CIA process itself is conducted without any statutory or regulatory authority. The only authority for the CIA procedure is a very short administrative order
which simply directs the representatives of principal state agencies and designated local communities to prepare a report on the proposed lease sale. A copy of the administrative order is attached for your information. The committee charged with preparation of the report is collectively referred to as the Agency Advisory Committee on Leasing, or to use another acronym, the AACL. The role of the AACL under the terms of Administrative Order 52 is strictly advisory and limited in scope. As pointed out earlier, the CIA has become a vehicle of ill-conceived and ill-advised recommendations which are then imposed as stipulations. The CIA process has taken the form of a federal environmental impact statement, even though the legislature has refused to authorize any such requirement in spite of past proposals that it do so. In our judgment, the CIA has become a redundant and unnecessary part of the pre-sale decision-making process, replete with increased bureaucratic staffing, high-cost consultants, delay and uncertainty, and diminishment of proper statutory authority over state leasing. More importantly, the CIA has become an avenue for impeding the development of the state's petroleum resources by affording opponents of development still another means of challenging the implementation of the state leasing program. The AACL has in effect placed itself in control of the leasing program through the CIA process. This is contrary to the state constitution and the provisions of the Alaska Lands Act, which place the responsibility with the Commissioner of Natural Resources and in fact require development of the state resources. The lengthy and involved procedures which the AACL has imposed on the CIA process are unnecessary in view of the many other processes which assure the thorough agency and public review of the state leasing program. The procedures which are designed to provide broad participation in the decision-making process include the following. One, hearings before the legislature each year in conjunction with the submittal of the five-year leasing program. Two, a call for nominations and comments on areas to be added to that leasing schedule. Three, an invitation to comment on specific acreage, that is, tracts to be included or excluded from specific schedules. Four, the opportunity to comment on the director's lengthy and involved decision and findings, which is required by law. Still another opportunity for public comment and hearing under the final notice of sale, also a legally mandated requirement. These steps assure a thorough review of the leasing process, including the terms and conditions to be imposed on oil and gas leases. In light of these procedures, we believe that the FIA process involving additional agency and public review is unnecessary. If there's any doubt that the AACL has set itself out as the final authority on the implementation of the state's oil and gas leasing program, one only has to look at the powers assumed by the committee for the leasing of state land. Step number 12 in the agency's timetable for the CIA process reads as follows. AACL, in conjunction with DPDP, prepares and submits to the governor, in writing and verbally, a final version of the project analysis. The analysis is to include the identification of major issues, specific conditions, and mitigating measures necessary for state approval of the sale. I think that pretty much sums up their the authority that this committee has assumed, and I think improperly so in view of the order. In other words, the AACL sees itself as the final authority over the implementation of the leasing program. Other mechanisms which are being used to impose unwarranted requirements in oil and gas operations are the various MOU between governmental agencies. Here again, these MOUs were well intended. However, what has evolved is a situation whereby agencies such as Fish and Game, DEC, and DPDP impose conditions on lessees without justification. Unlike the normal regulatory process, the MOUs are not subject to the public review process or appeal. Under these MOUs, an agency simply asserts that a particular condition is to be imposed on a permit, and that condition is imposed on the applicant. We have attempted without success to get the agencies to reconcile the conflicts that come from these, this process, and we haven't had any success or much success. So. In fact, the response, as pointed out earlier, has been a set of regulations, the uniform permit procedures, which would institutionalize the very problem or process that we now have. Since the administration seems unwilling or unable to come to grips with the issue of regulatory reform, we urge enactment of legislation which would require reasonable regulation. Mr. Bond will discuss the specific shortcomings of the bill under consideration today and make specific recommendations for the solution of problems for the regulatory process. I think with these two areas that I've described this morning, the TIA and the MOU, I think the central thing that can be done is to clearly establish an appropriate lead agency, and that agency should be DNR through the Division of Minerals and Energy Management. And I think it's imperative that that agency have the control over the leasing process, the ability to balance things out, and to make the decisions and the judgments that are required to have an effective leasing program. Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. And then I'll go right into Mr. Bond's testimony. I think we're getting pretty much back on time so that the board committee can ask questions about afterwards. Mr. Mark Bond.
Chairman Martin, Chairman Randolph, we certainly appreciate the opportunity to testify here. My name is Mark Bond. I'm an attorney with the law firm of Delaney, Weil, Page, Ratner, and Brubaker. I'm appearing on behalf of Chevron USA under the auspices of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association again. And I appreciate that we have a little time before lunch, and therefore, rather than read through my prepared transcript, I'd just like to hit the highlights in order that the members of the committee may have the opportunity to ask the many questions I know you must have of the previous individuals who testified. I have participated with the Regulatory Reform Committee for the past 2 years. In fact, it was the first job that I acquired when I arrived at the law firm of Delaney Wiles. And the pile of statutes and regulations that you held up, that E.G. Gilbreth held up, was drafted by myself. That was my first 3 weeks of work at the law firm. I spent 2 weeks reading through the statutes and developing that pile. And while I'm not totally familiar with the ins and outs of the actual operation of those statutes and regulations, I can certainly attest to the tremendous quantity of regulation of the oil and gas industry. It seems to me that our testimony can be summarized in the following way. Mr. Mims threw a challenge to us this morning as the first person to testify to show us some examples of where over-regulation has in fact hurt the oil and gas industry in the state. It seems to me that we've more than met that challenge. And in addition to that, I'd remind you that the examples that were given by the previous individuals who testified are only examples. And when we asked them to testify here, many of them said, well, how many examples do you want us to give, and which ones do you want? Because as the individuals who are in the front lines of this battle with the permitting process, they know of many, many more examples, and I hope that if you have inquiry or have doubts as to the fact that there are many problems in our area, if you make sufficient inquiry to satisfy yourself of that problem. Basically, the purpose of my testimony is to outline what we feel are the shortcomings of the bill that's now entitled the second rule version in front of the House, and to propose to you what has been passed out as a draft labeled 8-17-81, which the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, the majority of the members of that association, believe would solve some of these problems that we've outlined. And we want to make it clear that we don't view 84 as a panacea for these problems, but we do believe that a properly drafted bill would go a long way in solving many of our problems. There are other drafted bills available, and we urge you to consider those also. It is a complex area, as you can see from the testimony, and we don't claim to have the last word on everything. You'll notice that the findings of the two bills are identical, but beyond the findings, there are several important differences between the two versions, and I hope only to speak to three of those. The first provision concerns the appeals process. The second provision that I'd like to discuss concerns the lead agency and interagency review process. And the third topic is the time limit for permit processing. Now, as the members of the committee must be aware, the administration has proposed and adopted, although not promulgated, the Uniform Permit Procedure Regulation. Now, when we first made noises that we had permitting problems, this is the administration's answer to our permitting problems. There's another 32 pages, I believe, of regulations that we believe are, as previous witnesses have stated, are more harmful than the status quo.
That's Title 22 you haven't found out.
That's correct.
We do have topics of those.
It is the sincere belief of the majority of members of AOGA that if no permitting bill is adopted in this next session, or if a permitting bill along the lines of the second rules version is adopted, the administration will proceed and promulgate the Uniform Permit Procedure Regulations as they have been currently adopted by the committee. And we view SB 84 in a properly drawn manner as being the best vehicle by which to halt the promulgation of these harmful regulations. One of the most important differences between the second rules version and the AOGA draft are the respective provisions for appeal of permitting decisions. Now, you understand that what the previous witnesses have discussed deals only with the nitty-gritty of getting the permit approved in the first place. And beyond that, there's an additional appeals process that may or may not be affected as far as the applicant and others who are interested in the permitting decision are concerned. Our problem is with the regulations, and these regulations provide for more, one of the representatives commented, more turkey fat along the lines of what you see here. The first problem with the regulations is that they provide standing, as the representative agreed, referred to, for anyone who has testified on the permitting decision to appeal the permitting process. And therefore, anyone who's interested or disinterested or only slightly interested can get the individual into one of these. I've even got it upside down. But this is tacked on to the end of my testimony, and you'll see that the Class A appeal is about 95 to 125 days, and the Class B appeal is around 125 days. I think that comes back. I went through and added this up, and it's a little bit more than 125, but I think you get the point of this, and I'd urge you to take a look at this if you have any doubts on the appeals process. My comment on the regulation appeals process is that it's identical to a full-blown Superior Court civil trial, and my point is that we don't believe that a full-blown Superior Court civil trial is necessary in a permitting decision. And on page 4 of my testimony, I kind of outlined the various steps that you have to go through on a Class B appeal. In contrast to that, the August 17th draft provides that the applicant at his choice can appeal either to the commission of the particular agency or to the Superior Court. Now, if he feels he has an insufficient record and would like to develop the record more, he can appeal to the commissioner and have more hearings if he'd like before the commission. If, on the other hand, he feels there is sufficient record to support his application, he then has the option to go to the Superior Court directly. Now, while we know that court actions take a long time, I'd urge you to recognize the fact that if the Uniform Permit Regulations are adopted, the court actions would be on top of this request. So we feel that's justified. The second point I'd like to make is a very, very important distinction in the section governing interagency review. In both drafts, actually proposed, we have 4462635. We believe in the lead agency concept. We believe it is really important, as a number of speakers have told you, to avoid duplication. A lead agency must be established, and logically, The lead agency should be that agency that has primary jurisdiction over the particular activity involved. For oil and gas activities, of course, that would be the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Minerals and Energy Management. Both bills, as I said, establish a lead agency concept. Unfortunately, the second rules version greatly undermines, if not destroys, the lead agency concept by some language it contains, which says basically that in reaching its decision on the comments it's going to make, it must give great weight, as you heard one speaker refer to the comments of resource agencies within their area of expertise and also to the comments of coastal resource teachers to approve coastal management plans. And it's our contention that this does precisely what the lead agency concept was intended to do. Now, in the regulations, great ways to find it, quote, shifting the burden of proof to the deciding agency to reach a contrary conclusion. What that means, essentially, is if a comment is made by another agency that the lead agency believes is unjustified, the lead agency must go with its own experts, biological or engineering or whatever, and actually disprove by the preponderance of the evidence the comment that was made by the commenting agency. Now, once again, that's neat from a lawyer's perspective. Lawyers love that kind of stuff. But it's completely unnecessary in the permitting process insofar as lead agency, as a practical matter, is never going to invest the time or energy to disprove any comment. And therefore, any comment made by a commenting agency under this definition of good weight would have to be put on the permit. More stipulations, more conditions. As a lawyer, part of my duty is to review oil and gas lease sale procedures to ensure that the state has complied with the requirements of statutes and regulations. And I find this great weight decision frightening because, as it is plenty, if another agency suggests a comment and the lead agency does not adopt it, there's an obvious avenue of challenge to be able to get a lot of that sale. In the same vein, if another agency makes a comment and the lead agency says, well, that's nice, but let's tone it down a little bit, or let's put it in this compartment or something along that line, again, there's a ripe opportunity for any individual to challenge the legality of that sale. And it makes it really difficult for someone like me who is supposed to draw little opinions to make it an effective opinion and tell the company, yes, you can bid on this because it's a legal sale, or no, you can't because it's illegal. Now, in contrast to that, the August 17th draft provides what we believe is a truly balanced approach. And I'd just like to read you that language. The lead agency shall consider and balance all competing factors in reaching this decision, but shall make the final determination on the issuance of a consistency determination or comment on federal permit application and any conditions or stipulations to be placed thereon. This is truly a balanced approach. The provision allows for input from other agencies and from the coastal districts, and furthermore, it requires the lead agency to consider and balance all those comments. However, the ultimate authority is retained where it should be, in the lead agency, and the lead agency makes the final determination on what shall be imperative by way of stipulation or conditions on the permit. The final topic that I'd like to just briefly hit on is that both bills impose a 30 and 60-day deadline for, or 65-day deadline for issuing permit applications. However, the second rules version allows no fewer than 4 exceptions to that. One exception is that the applicant and the resource agency can agree to waive the established time period, and that seems nice on its surface, but it's an open invitation to blackmail, because an agency head will say, well, we don't want to issue you a permit. If you won't give us more time to consider it, now what would you like, a permit denial or to give us more time? And as Easy said, that's an offer that you can't refuse. The second situation is for unusually complex issues in the permit application. And we concur that there ought to be a provision allowing for extra time for unusually complex issues, but there's no limit on this time provision in the second rules version, and the ALGA version imposes a maximum of 120-day deadline, which we feel is more than adequate time to develop whatever information you need. The final thing that I'd like to hit on is that the second rules version also allows for a 20-day extension if you hold a public hearing on a permit. That's the public hearing process is precisely why there are two classifications. The first one for 3 days where there's no public hearing required, the second one for 65 days, an additional 35 days so they could hold a public hearing. That seems to me to obviate the necessity for an additional 20 days. I'd just conclude by stating that the Alaska Constitution and, of course, the Alaska Lands Act mandates the development of oil and gas in the state for the best interest of all the individuals in the state. And it seems to me that the legislature has fulfilled that promise, but in many instances, the bureaucratic morass simply delays and impedes that implementation. And to the extent that this can be cured by legislation, we believe that Senate Bill 84 is a good step in that direction.
Thank you, Mr. Bond. Before we get into questions, I'd like to ask if we could have a copy of your diagram there on the appeal problem.
Right, it's on the back end of the testimony.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Then, looks like we're just about 20 till 12, and I'm going to leave that time for questions from the committee. And then right after that, we'll have the
two persons from the various government departments lead off right after lunch, and then Mrs. Joyce Monson.
Okay, any questions, gentlemen?
Just one.
Mr. Booth.
Mr. Durango, do any of the state, what did I say?
Durango.
Durango? Sorry about that. Durango, I'm sorry about that. I have trouble with the employment. Do the state agency people ever go up there on those sites and go for that 15 miles and take a look at what really happens, or do they sit down in the offices and make a decision on it? Do they really know what they're talking about by actual seeing it and understanding the conditions involved in it, or do they just make a nice little decision based on some information they have in front of them and maybe a map?
No, they do take quite a few trips up to the slope. They are always telling me that one of their problems is that, but they don't have enough travel money to get up there as often as they'd like. That example that I gave you is a very good example, because in the chronology, it wasn't a state agency, but a federal agency who went up there. One other small issue, which was that the orientation of the pad had to be changed, and that we feel was valid because it protected a stream. But while they were up there on the ground, seeing that the stakes were not moved, one cannot help but think that they walked right past that fox den, which happened to be under the road as proposed, which we found out about in the construction process. Not the construction process, but on our own internal biological review of that project. So they do get up there. In fact, ARCO has found that we have adopted one small procedure which seems to give us big benefits in smoothing out the problems in our getting our permits, and that is we send the agencies out a map now. And the map just gives circles in areas where we're going to propose projects for the succeeding year. And yes, they do go up there and take a look at it. They say, rightly or wrongly, that they don't have enough time or money to do it, but we feel confident they do it. Our people on the slope tell us that there's agency people up there, so we know they do. To say that they didn't would imply bad faith on their part, and I don't think it's bad faith, but what I think it is these hypotheses that you got a hypothesis searching for a factual basis to support it on. And that's what we see happening. We feel that there a lot of the hypotheses don't have factual basis, but until it's proven that they don't, which is a virtual impossibility, they're going to assume that they do. And that's one of our biggest problems. That plus the fact that in an insistence upon a stipulation to mitigate this hypothetical result that you can't disprove, in the oil business, things happen fast. Time is a natural enemy to an economically designed, constructed, and operated project. If it's an enemy to the one who wants to do it, it's an ally of the one who doesn't want you to do it or who wants you to change it around to his liking. And that's another one of our problems.
Thank you very much.
Sir. Into lunch period.
Senator, question.
It looks like we're just about 5 till 12. How about if we have a lunch break, and right after that we'll begin with Mr. Glenn Atkins, the Department of Environmental Conservation.
I mean, to have speak this afternoon is Mr. Woody Ants, and I think you're going to be finding his testimony, although short, asking to come in specially to speak before us, although he wasn't listed. And you notice earlier today I brought forth this book here that lists various permits and the procedure through the federal, the state, and the borough. And I happened to run into Mr. Anks about 2 months ago when he sent out this little blurb on how you can buy another book on what to do and how to do with government permits. And he has that new book available. And I think in his short presentation, we'll not only find out how many permits they are, but hopefully some guidelines, if there's any at all available. Mr. Ents.
Thank you, Representative Martin, Representative Randolph, and committee members. For the record, I am Woody Angst, spelled A-N-G-S-T. I'm with the Department of Environmental Conservation. My responsibilities with the department are for the processing of permits and increasingly now the permit simplification and interagency coordination. As you just learned, a project I've recently been involved in is the publication of this book. It was, I'll pass it around so you might look at it as I speak. It was originally published several years ago by the Departments of Commerce and Economic Development and the Department of Environmental Conservation. The intent was to provide a descriptive inventory of all federal, state, and local permits which are issued for the development and initial operation of projects in the state of Alaska. The book was updated in 1979, the copy you have in front of you. Unfortunately, Commerce and Economic Development had to drop out of the program. DEC picked it up this past spring and has now put it on a sustained subscription basis. By that I mean we have updated the entire text of some 350 permits that we've identified to date. The description for each permit includes a statement of purpose, a brief description of the permit, the basic requirements that must be met procedurally for its issuance, and if we can, the technical requirements, the authorities under which it's issued, and the contacts within the agencies for the issuance and technical assistance on the permit. In the back, there are two indices. One is the subject index for keyword or permit title. There's also a major project index for things like port development, oil and gas operation, logging, fishing, whatever. The book was originally available gratis through the departments. We had 1,500 copies made available at a price tag of $30,000 or $40,000 for printing alone. This book was very popular with the agencies who were the original audience for its preparation, and increasingly popular with the consultants, major developers, industry in the state, and even many of the library systems and small operators, the commercial people in our state. With that in mind, in trying to reach this audience, the decision was made to make the book available on a subscription basis rather than gratis through the department. This eliminates a heavy financial burden on the taxpayer and a budgeting hassle for the department, and the consumer has the opportunity to purchase it. Pre-printing price was $35. Now that it's been out for a month or so, the price is $45, and they will reprint as necessary to meet whatever the demand. We anticipate that a much broader audience will want the book. Early returns seem to confirm that. The book will be updated every January. A four-year subscription to these supplements is available for an additional $50. All of this is being done by Printmore Corporation here in Alaska, so the private sector has become involved in this project. Once we get through the five-year cycle, we will recycle with a complete new printing of the entire book, and then the supplements will follow again. I would add that the apparatus to keep this going is in place under Alaska Statute 4635. The Department of Environmental Conservation does house the Alaska Permit Information Center. The research done by that staff in assisting developers identify agencies with jurisdiction and permits that might be required has become the basic research necessary for this text. And because of the interest in the text, we will continue that research, feeding the information to Printmore Corporation. I think that's what you were hoping for. If I can answer questions, I'll be glad to try.
Yeah, thank you very much. I just had two questions. I thought I put my order in before the price went up. Would I still be on it? Because I'm going to leave a comment.
I certainly shall, and I have a call into Printmore to find out why you don't have yours.
Okay,
I will follow up for you.
We'll pay you, but I don't want to pay the addition.
Well, don't pay me. Pay Printmore.
Okay. And then also, with all the work that you've done in the past few years over this, not to put you on the spot, but I think that you've probably had more to do with permits and the network that everyone must go through to get something. Is there any general concept that you have developed that may help the system?
This is off the top of the head. I wasn't prepared for it. I have a couple observations. Personal to a certain degree, I think in part shared by the department. A lot of what we, and by we I mean you as legislators, these gentlemen as the industry, myself as a regulatory agency are confronted with, is something that is not under our immediate control. There were a couple examples this morning where legislation has come down from Congress, binds us all. One of the examples this morning pointed to the Corps of Engineers, DEC, and the Office of Coastal Management. The three laws behind those references are all federal statutes. None of us have much control over that. As a result of statutes such as those, you as a legislature have enacted certain laws. Agencies such as DEC have in turn promulgated regulations, sometime with great proliferation, other times not at all, but the point is we've promulgated regulations. My observation in all that is that through this proliferation, we have a lot of requirements which may or may not be good. That's a question that we would have to deal with philosophically. And as I try and implement the system, to make the system work if you like, I find a great deal of contradiction and inconsistency in the language of those regulations. For example, the requirement for public notice, both in statute and regulation, I find the requirement for one, two, or even three notices for a single permit by the appropriate agency. Requirements for that public notice to be printed daily, consecutively, or weekly on designated days. The requirement for the commissioner to issue, the director of the agency to issue, the agency to issue, the agency to cause to be issued, or the applicant to issue. These can be mailed out or they can be published in a newspaper. The permutations on those scenarios are beyond your and my comprehension, and yet I as an agency must work with my sister agencies to streamline a process at your direction. And the developers bear the brunt of this because ultimately they're paying the bill for it, either in dollars for the processing or in lost time, which is also dollars. So I think we really need to do some house cleaning. The last observation I would make is that much of the work to make the system work gets to be forms management. For example, this last year, DEC has worked with Natural Resources, Fish and Game, and several federal agencies to put together a master application for the placer miner industry. The application was professionally designed with a technical input from our field staff and with the consultation of the industry. It's a form that met all of the agency's needs. It was a form that enabled the miner to clearly lay out a description of his project, provide the factual data the agencies needed for their evaluations, and the agencies in turn could glean that information for a quick evaluation and essentially rubber stamp permits once the procedural requirements were met. The nice thing about an effort like that is there was no cost to anybody for it, it was recognized by the forms industry nationally and internationally as the best form produced last year, to such a degree that that industry is looking for a article from the state of Alaska, which will be published in December, about our regulatory process and how something like forms management can play such an important part of it. There's other things that can be done. This is a very different tack from what we talked about this morning, but these are the mechanics, the tools to make the system work, which I think must also be addressed. You people can set out the requirement, there shall be a public notice. The agencies then would have to devise the forms, determine the frequency of notice and whatnot, and do the house cleaning and their regulations. No one of us can do it alone or by ourselves out of context. We must do it together. The rightness or wrongness of the regulations, there's, you know, 20 years or 40 years now of philosophy behind that coming out of the Second World War. And philosophically, our society is going to have to come to grips with that question. I don't think we can do it today, but we can simplify the permit process, and I think we can dig in right away on that note.
Thank you, sir. Any other questions, gentlemen, Mr. Randall?
I think I just missed some things. You're with whom?
I'm with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation.
Okay, and who publishes the book?
The department provides the factual data. Printmore Corporation here in Anchorage is printing it and making distribution. They are recovering a fee for that service.
Under a contract with the department?
There is no monetary contract with the department. They approached us and asked for the opportunity. We have a an agreement which the Attorney General's office helped us prepare, by which we will provide the information to them in a certain format, and they will print and distribute. There is no copyright by the state on it. Printmore does have a copyright on the format.
I just make one suggested improvision, is we ought to put a big welcome to Alaska on there. Sarcastically.
Any other questions?
Thank you very much, Mr. Hanks. Appreciate your time. Next person that will be speaking is Mrs. Lloyd Adams from the Department of Law, and I think she's specifically going to be talking on Title 22.
That's correct.
And thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Laurie Adams, and I'm with the State Attorney General's Office. I'm here today to try to provide you with a bit of an overview of the administration's efforts to date on regulatory reform. So far today, you've heard considerable testimony about the complexities of the permitting system and the reasons why a comprehensive reform effort is needed. Now, some of the individual examples which have been described by the previous speakers might be contested on their facts. But the administration as a whole does not disagree with the underlying problem. The permitting process is complicated procedurally and stands in substantial need of streamlining and revision. On its face, therefore, a permit reform bill, like the one introduced at the beginning of last session as SB 84, may appear to contain an appealing quick fix for all the complicated problems inherent in the state administrative law. However, based on our longstanding involvement with advising the administrative agencies and our continuing efforts to solve the recognized shortcomings and inconsistencies of our administrative system, I caution that at the outset, permit reform is very complicated both legally and from a policy perspective, and is not amenable to the sort of quick fix approach with which the Senate Committee substitute for SB 84 represents. In addition, the complexity, as others have testified here today, is in many ways determined by the strictures of federal laws and regulations, which the state must respond to through its own regulatory authorities. We've now been through two entire legislative sessions in which the sequence of events on permit reform legislation has been discouragingly similar. In both 1980 and 1981, unacceptably simplistic and likely unconstitutional in some ways in our view, permit reform bills were introduced at the beginning of each session, were debated at numerous public hearings where representatives of interest from all the polar extremes attacked them for different shortcomings, And at the end of each session, when it became apparent that none of the hasty proposals was going to pass, they were subject to a massive rewrite effort in an attempt to reach a last-minute responsible compromise solution. In both 1980 and 1981, as you're aware, these efforts failed in the last hours of the session, and we were left with an undesirable continuation of the status quo for another year. The administration has been very involved in this legislative process all along and is understandably anxious to avoid a renewed prolonged battle again next year, which would delay the implementation of any real, meaningful, and needed reform. At the end of the 1980 session, when the committee substitute for SB 548 died in the House Rules Committee on adjournment, the governor committed the administration to going forward with implementation of the major provisions of that bill administratively by regulation. An attorney from my office was assigned full-time to work for approximately 9 months on the project, which was aimed at developing and adopting uniform procedural regulations applicable to all permits of the Departments of Natural Resources, Environmental Conservation, Fish and Game, and the Coastal Management Consistency Determinations conducted by the Division of Policy Development and Planning in connection with projects needing federal permits or licenses. The effort included working sessions with various representatives of industry starting last September, numerous informal sessions with both industry and environmental groups as the regulations progressed through the working draft stages last fall, and a formal public comment period on the public notice draft of the regulations, which was distributed in January. The comment period was extended until April 1st of this year because of the complexity of the issues addressed in the regulations, and three public hearings were held by the administration during that period. In addition, the Coastal Policy Council considered the regulations at three separate public meetings of that body last fall and this spring. The regulations were adopted near the end of the legislative session by all of the state departments and the Coastal Policy Council, but the governor subsequently determined to defer putting them into effect, in part to allow their review by the Administrative Regulations Review Committee, but also because he hopes that it might be possible to resolve remaining differences primarily with some members of the oil industry, which would permit passage of an acceptable permit reform bill very early in the next legislative session. Passage of such a bill might require some amendments of the regulations adopted by the administration, and the governor was reluctant to add to the confusion by implementing immediately such an extensive series of changes in the existing permitting system that there was a substantial likelihood that a new law on the subject would soon be forthcoming. As a result of the administration's earnest and continued efforts to accommodate the serious concerns articulately expressed by all segments of industry and the public, we have developed a file of public comments on the regulations, which is perhaps unprecedented in size, I think it numbers in the hundreds of pages. And we believe that we've also adopted a set of final regulations which do a good job of solving the really pressing, tough legal issues surrounding regulatory reform while simplifying and making uniform the procedures which an applicant must comply with in order to receive needed permits from state resource agencies. The administration's uniform regulations have received the support of a wide cross-section of the public, including industry representatives, such as the Alaska Loggers Association, the Alaska Corporation, and they have broad municipal and public interest support, such as from the City and Borough of Juneau, the League of Women Voters, Southeast and District Iron Native Association. I've provided a brief summary of the key goals of those regulations, and although I don't have the copies with me at the moment, I'd be happy to provide all of the committee members with copies of the regulations and of the executive summary which accompanies the regulations, which lays out in considerable detail exactly what they do. And if anyone wants to get to it, public comment file, which is quite thick. The regulations accomplish basically three specific objectives which the administration used as the central problem of the existing permit process. First, the regulations which are, they will be codified in 22AAC, that's why we've been referring to that number, replace the current system of state procedures which vary substantially between and within agencies without apparent reason or explanation. If one set of uniform procedural rules not found in a single location in the administrative code. Although these regulations may look long and evolved at first glance, we're dealing with some very complex administrative processes, and in reality, they cut through a tremendous morass of distinct individual agency regulations, administrative orders, and implementing memorandums of understanding between agencies to provide a single, uniform set of procedures for the issuance of permits. Included are two basic classes of permits. The research agencies are responsible for dividing their particular permits between the two classes, depending on the relative complexity and the degree of public interest or controversy that particular types of projects are likely to generate. The regulations also contain two classes of appeals, one informal, which is at the option of the applicant, and a formal longer appeal mechanism, which includes the traditionally required adjudicatory process.